And welcome to Foolproof Theology. My name is Chase Davis, and I am your host. It is good to be with you. I hope you enjoyed our last episode with Yuri Brito. We had a great conversation. If you didn't get a chance to listen to that, go ahead and head on over to the podcast or YouTube to check that out. Today, we have the honor of being with Dr. Clifford Humphrey. Dr. Clifford Humphrey is down at Troy University, where he just moved to. And I was just reading his bio here from the announcement there at Troy. And he has a fascinating journey going from Georgia to Palm Beach Atlantic University, learning woodworking in New York City, doing some world traveling, getting a PhD at Hillsdale, and then helping launch Thales College in Raleigh, North Carolina. And now he's at Troy University in Alabama. You know, this has been a crazy journey, Clifford. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Was this a journey you had seen for yourself when you were a young boy, that this is kind of the trajectory you would be on?
I always did have a bit of a wanderlust, but I find that every time I leave home, I have a greater appreciation and love for home. So my journey has been a kind of there and back again. And so I'm as close to home as I'm an hour and a half from my family in Georgia, now here in Alabama. So I'm finally getting wonderful. Closer to roots.
That's great. Well, I started following Clifford on Twitter. You know, there was some overlapping circles of influence. I think some people have actually done some maps on that on Twitter, which is a different topic for a different day. But I really enjoy the content he was putting out, the way he was thinking clearly about things and just being a contributor in that way. And he's hosted a couple of rooms. But one article he put out that's really fascinating with Ad Fontes is on Mere Christianity. And that's a book I've recommended, I've benefited from. In fact, I was just reviewing it the other night because it took me, I think, 5 years to get through it when I was a teenager, just because it was really challenging. But what Clifford suggests in the article is that people have misread to a great detriment to their own spirituality the book Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. And so I'm like, okay, that's fascinating. Let's hear more about that. So what is kind of the premise of that suggestion? Should Christians not be reading Mere Christianity, Clifford?
Right. Yeah, I was hoping to be a little provocative with the title, but it is a provocative topic. So yeah, let's dive in. I should say first off that Mere Christianity has a really important part in my life too. I ended up getting a degree in political philosophy from Hillsdale College, and my first step toward any sort of philosophical leaning was definitely seventh grade youth leader introducing me to some couple passages from Mere Christianity. And so that lit a spark that I still carry, you know, a flame today. So I'm always very grateful for that book, and it is very helpful. What I started thinking about recently, though, was that we have turned Lewis's concept of bringing Christianity down to its lowest common denominator, the merest form of it, and we've kind of fetishized it. We've glorified it to be this great, wonderful thing. Because why? Well, because it means it's what we can all agree on. And my temperament is such that I'm kind of a peacemaker. I don't like conflict. I'm always trying to help people get along, and I completely understand and get that. And as I note in the article, that accords with our Lord's prayer in the Gospel of John, that we would be united together as we are, as He is with the Father. And so I understand where it comes from, but I want to point out that there's some problems to trying to make bring all of Christianity down to a sort of lowest common denominator form. And I think it's particularly important for Protestants. So as I was reflecting on this, I reread the preface, and I was struck that Lewis says exactly not to do what, in fact, we have done, which is to replace the creeds of the existing communions, which he doesn't give a full list, but he says we know what those are. Generally speaking, there's the Anglican Church, the Orthodox Church, the Roman Catholic Church. And he says, of course, he's a part of the Anglican Church. And he says, I don't want to replace mere Christianity with one of those, replace those with mere Christianity. Don't think that's what I'm trying to do. He says, what I'm trying to do is create a way to bring my unbelieving neighbor into the hallway of Christianity. And he uses this metaphor of the hallway leading into different rooms, and the rooms are the existing communions. And he says, I want to get them into the hallway, but then I want them to get into a room And he says emphatically, I think three times in different ways, don't stay in the hallway. The hallway, he says, is bare. It's barren. He says it's in the rooms where you find the meals and the chairs and the fireplaces, the life. And what I think we've done, largely speaking, in Protestant America, at least that's my experience. I grew up non-denominational, very low Southern Baptist. I'm Anglican now. I think we have kind of put a tent in the hallway and we've camped out there and we've said, let's just stay here. And what's even more interesting is I think we've said this is a higher spiritual plane. It's kind of better than being in one of the rooms. And we can certainly chat about whether that's true or not. The only argument I'm making is that Lewis does not endorse that. Lewis said, don't stay in the hallway. In fact, there's no life here. He said he even uses the word camping. He says it's a place for waiting, not for camping. And so he views it as a place from which to observe and decide all the among the different rooms which one you ought to go in. Now, I know, Chase, you're a pastor of a non-denominational church, and so I know we're talking about non-denominationalism in one way, but and we can talk about that. But what I talk about in the article, close to the bottom, is that even among the sort of spirit of non-denominationalism has gotten into the existing communions, and so even the Anglican Church, if you go to the website, I haven't checked it lately, but when I wrote the article, it was still true. If you go to the ACNA website, the Anglican Church in North America, it equates Anglicanism with mere Christianity.
Oh.
Which is to say it dissolves the distinction between the room and the hallway for Anglicans. Wow. Which is absurd if you think about Lewis making this observation as a member of the Anglican Church, saying there's the hallway and then there's this room that I'm in. And that's very common, and it makes sense that would happen because Lewis wrote Mere Christianity as an Anglican, and so it's very common for people to say, oh, well, this is kind of what he meant. He meant to describe Anglicanism as a form of mere Christianity, that lowest common denominator kind of thing. So anyway, I've been rambling quite a bit, but I was struck by how forcefully he said, don't make this confusion. Don't confuse the hallway and the rooms. And we've done that, and like I've said, even more than that, we've glorified it. And that just really, really struck me. And you noted anthropology is really where I go in the article, because what I think Lewis notes is to say the kind of being that we are as humans, we need the things that you find in the rooms. We're not the kind of beings that can worship God together in communities over sustained over generations, on a bare minimum kind of mere level of Christianity as is found in the hallways. So,
you know, what's interesting about what you're saying is that the kind of article by James Wood in First Things, and then a follow-up in American Reformer, Wood's approach and critique overlaps a lot with this in my mind, because a lot of the critique boils down to reducing the gospel and evangelism to an apologetic approach that's very like generic, right? And very accommodating. So what do you do in a hallway, you know, in the foyer of a house? You welcome somebody in, you greet them. But if that's all the gospel is for someone, well, they're not going to feel very welcome because they've never been invited to sit down and have a meal. And so what Woods and you are suggesting, many others are seeing, is that evangelical Christianity, Protestant Christianity in America has taken on mere Christianity as a kind of a jacket or an approach to evangelism, when in fact that's not, like, whereas Lewis would say it is an approach, it's to welcome somebody into the hall, but you're not getting them in the room where we're supposed to have a meal. And so that transition to open the door to invite them to sit down and say, let's go further than this. It's supposed to be that. It's not supposed to be the end-all, be-all of Christianity. Is that kind of what you're picking up on?
Yeah, and I hadn't made the connection that you just made with Wood's argument about winsomeness and making everything about evangelization. And what we're forgetting, of course, is discipleship. We're forgetting that, and not just discipleship, but how do you disciple generations, whole families? And of course, there's a baptism theology distinction here that not everyone's going to agree with. But if you have a covenantal reformed kind of perspective, then how can you need whole communities to disciple children, and you know, without thinking of age of accountability as some, you know,
sure,
distinction you're making, how do you create communities that do that, who don't reduce everything to evangelization? I think that's a really profound connection, and it's not, that's not, that didn't happen accidentally. I think that there's a very clear path for how we got here. It's interesting,
okay,
too, that you used the metaphor of putting on a jacket. You said that's a jacket that we've put on. The reason that's funny is I'll preview a little work I'm doing right now that I hope to come out this winter, maybe next spring, is my former Anglican priest at Hillsdale College, Adam Rick, he and I are partnering together to republish a work of Jonathan Swift's called A Tale of a Tub, which I would venture to say I've never met anyone who's ever read it. Everyone reads,
okay,
parts of Gulliver's Travels. No one reads his other stuff, maybe his short story about, you know, the A Modest Proposal. But A Tale of a Tub is a story of the early church, and it starts with the early church, and it goes through, it's a history of the church. And it uses a metaphor of jackets and these three sons and a father who wills these jackets to his sons. And it's,
sure,
absolutely hilarious. It's a little hard for us to get because some of the jokes, we're sort of distanced from the Reformation and all the things that were going on that he's making fun of. So Adam Rick and I are publishing an edition of this work with commentary to help expose, make the jokes a little more accessible. But the idea of the coats is actually more profound than you realize, probably, because one of the sons represents a version of Protestantism that, let's just say, he destroys his coat and he creates a kind of Christianity that is spiritual and it is not embodied or physical or a kind of, it's all spiritual. And so Swift calls that sect that he founds the Aeolists, which connotes wind, and he talks about their preaching as so much belching and farting or something like that, because it's all just wind. It's really, really funny, rich. But when
amazing.
when we reduce our religion to a list of beliefs and not practices and not ways of being and ways of living, it can easily become that, just overly spiritualized. And that's how you get people, you know, the logic of I'm walking alone in the woods listening to a sermon and I'm going to call that church.
Right.
That made sense to me when I was growing up. Why? That's a really good question. Why does that make sense, that someone can say, I went for a walk in the woods and I listened to a sermon and I did that instead of going to church and I'm going to consider that just as good? How did we get there?
Yeah, that's a major issue that I face in Boulder.
You
get Christians that move here and they're disenchanted with conservative Christianity that they grew up with for a variety of reasons. And they move here and you say, or someone like me says, you should become a member of our church. And they're like, I don't need you and I don't need no church. I just need me and Jesus.
And the mountain, and, baby. Yeah, right.
Yeah, and that's where I'm going to go have church. You know, one way that I've been trying to flesh out this idea in my context is, so we just bought a church building and we're going to move into it. It's a Nazarene building. They built it in the 60s. Very reflective of Nazarene theology. It's very plain. Hmm. And that's fine. But we're going to help dress it up a bit. But there was a First Baptist Boulder, okay? And First Baptist Boulder did what most Baptist churches did in the last 30 years. They removed the name Baptist, right?
Yes.
In an
yes.
effort to make their distinction go away, because Baptist is seen as this boogeyman that's going to scare the secular people, scare the neighbors.
Yep.
They'll never come to church if it says Baptist on the front. And so I was talking with a local Baptist minister just last week. And I joked because this church changed its name from First Baptist Boulder to something completely else.
Yeah.
And I said, well, that name is probably available. So why wouldn't we just change the Wells name, that's our church's name now, to First Baptist Boulder so we can just totally own our distinctives.
There you go.
And just live into it. And he's like, that doesn't make any sense at all. And I was like, it makes complete sense in my mind.
Yeah.
If what you're saying and what I'm on to in terms of liturgy and practice, because I'm... Like if you were to boil down my ecclesiology and that kind of thing, it would be Baptist. But I'm like, we should live into that distinction.
Yes.
And we should embrace it, because that will cultivate people in a way of thinking and embodying the Christian faith that's yes. much more robust yes.
right.
than this kind of stripped down, generic, you know, fast food version of Christianity.
Yes. No, we could have a lot of conversations on this topic. I joke that non-denominational churches are completed Baptist churches. that's where they want to go. They want to go to that place. And so some of them are in various, you know, but why? Again, why? And I think to go back to the James Wood thing, it's all about being more and more and more winsome, right?
Right.
To the point where you've changed the name, right? You've picked up some name like Uplift or Potential Church or whatever it is you think is going to appeal.
Connect.
Architecture, everything is... But at some point, you've lost yourself. And I end my article by noting, at the end of Mere Christianity, Lewis talks about personality and how there's an urge to be authentic and unique to ourselves, right? And Lewis talks about it's actually when we find our identity in Christ, or when we're trying to live to mimic Christ, that we become our true selves, right? It's not by trying to be unique. He says there's nothing more unoriginal than trying to be unique, you know? And I see that same phenomenon working out in churches now, though. They're always trying to be unique and come up with the name that no one else has ever picked before. And you know, it's not just Baptist churches. There's a Methodist church behind where I live, and they just took off the word Methodist. Now, I know they're going through some reforms in that church, but this was even before those happened. So that goes to my point that this isn't just a Baptist and a non-denominational phenomenon. This is going into all of the other. There's sort of a spirit that's infecting all of the Protestant denominations, and probably some of the Roman Catholics as well. Not Roman Catholic denominations, but specific churches. A desire to kind of, they're sort of embarrassed a little bit of their distinctives. And
for sure, you connect that with anthropology.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted to drill down on, because we want to talk about anthropology and education, because you and I have a overlap there in terms of interest.
Yeah.
Because that's what I'm researching with the Puritans, is theological anthropology. And so I want to hear, what is the misguided anthropological assumptions that this approach to mere Christianity makes?
Yeah. So my critique is actually it's pretty similar to James K. Smith's idea of, you know, pushing back against the Cartesian model of humans as sort of brains on a stick. And I know he's kind of gone off the reservation a little bit himself, so I don't follow him very far. But I do appreciate that analogy that is not human, right? That's not how we live. But for some reason in the era in which we live now, there's a kind of tendency to build our lives as though that's the way we exist. And so I think what Mere Christianity does, what Lewis is attempting to do, is to get people to assent to certain beliefs with their brain, mm-hmm. right? And he appeals to their you know, their logic, right? And he wants to get them into the hallway where they have assented to these beliefs with their brains. But they haven't done anything with their bodies. They haven't changed their habits. And what they need are communities that offer them a kind of treadmill, if you will, for how to live. Here's a new rhythm. Every Sunday we do this, and maybe every Wednesday we do this. And how about every morning we do this, and every evening we do that? And so I use, to help explain this, I rely on a workout group that I'm a part of called F3, which probably some people have heard of. It's a little kooky, and it's that way on purpose. And what I've discovered in my 2 years or so of being a part of this, you know, they meet outside, they only do, you know, it's only men, and they do body weight stuff, and they have funny names for everything, and they go to great lengths to make everything quirky. But that's actually that's actually the secret sauce for helping it work and keeping people coming back, is they feel like there's a distinct group that they belong to that has its own ways of being. And once you learn what those are, and you only learn what those are by continuing to show up, you feel a strong sense of belonging and a strong sense of loyalty to that group. And there's a liturgy to every workout. And I can go, and I have gone, traveled all over the country for different conferences and that kind of a thing, and I'll join the local F3 group that's meeting at that city in that time. And it's just like going to an Anglican parish in a different city that has the same prayer book. I can jump right into it. There's a liturgy. And it accords, I sense this in like a deep part of my being, it accords with a with a more true understanding of human anthropology, of who we are as human beings. It connects not just on a mental level, but on a physical level as well. And so I think really behind this, there's some incarnational theology that we've got to wrestle with. The Anglicans are I think I appreciate the kind of the position that we have theologically towards the Eucharist, which leaves a lot to mystery, but it still has a robust understanding of real presence and incarnation. And so there's a physicalness that's a physicality that's a part of the worship that I think accords with a more true understanding of anthropology. And unfortunately, and this comes out with the Jonathan Swift book really well, which is why I want to help republish it, is it helps show that the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation, was a really good response to real abuses in the church. But there's a ditch on the other side, and I'm afraid we don't have the categories that help prevent us from falling into that other ditch often enough. The one that you were describing earlier about people saying, I don't need to go to church, I'm spiritual, not religious, all the things we're familiar with. How did we get there? I think we got there because we didn't have any rails to prevent us from going all the way on as we're sort of correcting still from the abuses that we encountered in the medieval church. So, so anthropology, I think, is a key to helping to understand why this is the way it is. So connecting with education, I went to Palm Beach Atlantic University in South Florida. It was founded by Baptists, and at some point it became non-Baptist and just became mere Christian. I went to graduate school at Hillsdale College, founded in 1844 by Free Will Baptists. Sometime shortly thereafter, it became mere Christian as well. That is the story I find all over this country, all these colleges that were founded, not always by Baptists, but they were founded by a distinctly denominational ethos, charism, you might say. And then at some point in their history, it became non-denominational. In essence. And I think that it did for certain reasons. I think that there was enough of agreement on certain basic beliefs in the country that you could do that in a way that worked. But what I'm suggesting is that I don't think we're in that moment anymore, right, to rely on Aaron Wren's distinction. If we're in the negative world, what does that mean? It means certain things. One is, what have we noticed? How many of these colleges are no longer Orthodox? How many of them have been taken over by the du jour political thing, right? Whatever is going on today is the latest thing. And so what would prevent those colleges from doing that? So I think that by adopting a mere Christian perspective today in the 21st century, I don't think they have the equipment, the resources to be able to prevent them from sort of falling into the political fads. So what I call for is a refounding of more denominationally distinctive colleges. One of my best friends attended Thomas Aquinas College in California. And, you know, he went in there knowing it was a robustly Roman Catholic institution. And, I won't quite say he plundered the Egyptians, but, you know, he, in essence, he got everything he could from that robust community and and learned a lot from them and came out still Protestant. But we don't have a lot of Protestant colleges that are like that, that are robustly denominational. And so we don't have the tools that a lot of the Roman Catholic colleges have where they're putting an emphasis on formation that I think we don't have.
Yeah, for sure. I compare it this way. When we planted our church in Boulder, we were so young and just ignorant in a lot of ways. But one of the challenges was I didn't know what I was doing. Mm-hmm. I hadn't worked in a church before. Like, all of these things were huge liabilities. And then I discovered that other people had planted churches. And not only that, there were entire ministries devoted to giving you all the bylaws and documents you need for your church.
Wow.
Instead of just making it up. So like you can like put your name in the template. It's just like starting a, I mean, to put it plainly, it's like any business where you would go to, you know, LegalZoom or something.
Right.
Well, I didn't know that. Well, what I've kind of discovered over the last few years with confessionalism and looking at church creeds and confessions and denominationalism is it's similar. A lot of Christians are trying to navigate the Christian life, and any time a question pops up, they don't have the resources, the guardrails, the path that's already been laid. And then all of a sudden you start reading church confessions and you start reading creeds and you start studying denominations and you're like, people have been asking these questions forever. Mm. Like, we have the resources right in front of us, but instead we've opted for a more generic, I think generic, I want to use a word that is insulting on purpose, because I think the spirituality of evangelicalism and non-denominationalism, as am I, right, that just reduces it to some kind of mere Christianity is super generic and boring. It's not helpful, and it doesn't create guardrails for people to not become either woke or like you said, dip into whatever the social matter is of the day and make that the chapel content that we're going to hear at the Baptist, formerly Baptist college.
Right.
And I just wish so many more people. So I guess my pushback on that might be, though, okay, fine, we're all going to do what you say. What denominations, you know, let's say I join the Southern Baptist, I'm going to start a uniquely Southern Baptist college, you know, in Colorado, which would be crazy, very fun to think about, but crazy. Yet the Southern Baptists themselves, granted that they're not really a denomination, they're like a network. Like when you look at the Southern Baptists, they're at such disagreement even amongst their own Baptist faith and message. They have so much discord within the camp. There's really not a purity of doctrine. Even the PCA is racked by this. So, like, if someone were to say, okay, fine, I'll start one, like, it seems like the denominations have become so corrupted by this attitude that which one would you even want to? Would it just be an Anglican one, since you're Anglican? What would you suggest?
Right. Well, of course, the Anglican Episcopal Church is flawless and has no problems whatsoever.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's obviously not true. So it's, yeah, I mean, the obvious pushback is to say, yeah, well, you think, you think the non-denominational churches have problems, look at the mainline. Of course.
Sure.
I would say different things work better at different times and different circumstances, right? And like I said, during the 19th, 20th century, you know, the non-denominational kind of mere Christian thing worked because we were such a robustly Protestant and theistic and pious country in a lot of ways, obviously not in every way.
Sure.
That worked. But I would just say, let's look at what do we need right now? What do the circumstances today call for? And I think they do call for a more robust way of living, right? So that's going to be a mix of two things. It's going to be a mix of rediscovering what are our roots. And it's going to be, secondly, it's going to be creating new ways, right, that are informed by our old ways, right, and being very careful what are these new things we're doing. But eschewing this idea we have to innovate constantly.
Yeah, it's exhausting.
In order to appeal to the, you know, the whatever, you know, that's not a winning strategy. You know, my personal journey from Baptist to non-denominational to PCA to Anglican, what I've discovered in the Anglican Church was much more of what I just sense. This is anthropologically, this is more accurate. This accords with what seems to be the way of human flourishing. And they have the great resource of the prayer book. Now, of course, I can hear people saying, which prayer book?
Sure.
We fight over that too. We have a prayer book, okay? And it's a prayer, a book of what? Of common prayer. And it's described best as the Bible arranged for worship. It is dripping with scripture. And it allows us to... It provides that treadmill, like I was describing before, for us to jump on. Here's how to order your day. Here's how to order your week and your month and your year, and you can get whole communities to do that. That works well for us. What resources do the Baptists have? For one thing, they have a really good music, you know, traditional hymns. There's a lot of really good Baptist hymns, and those things carry over into generations, right? little children that hear their mothers singing hymns to them in the crib, right, will be able to pass that on. And that creates some kind of cohesion. So that's something that the Baptists can lean on. You know, the other thing they do is they stress really well, you know, evangelism and, you know, the way that they plant churches. I mean, you can go through any little tiny town in the South to this day and still see, you know, a little Baptist church usually across the street from a Methodist church because they did that really well, too. And so those are ethos. That's an ethos in the Baptist church. I think you can lean on to really that could be helpful, you know, and then but then trying to figure out what does that look like today, you know?
Yeah.
So for me, the Anglican Church has the capacity. It's not a silver bullet. It's not going to solve all your problems. You still have to have faithful people. You still have to have good leadership. Right now, we're really struggling with all of that. You know, in fact, all of the bishops are meeting in England right now for Lambeth, and it's not clear that the Anglican Church in North America is going to have a future with the rest of the communion in the way that we'd like. You know, that's still very rocky. So I don't want to give out the idea that all you got to do is figure out some tradition and then just lean into it and you're good. Obviously, that didn't work for Rome. That's why we're Protestants.
Sure.
So, but I am saying that that's a useful tool that Protestants have neglected, and unfortunately, they have made that part of their tradition to not have traditions, right?
Yeah.
And we all know the scripture, right? When Jesus says, "You Pharisees, you know, you follow the traditions of man over the commandments of God," and we've made a tradition out of that, right? That we don't have tradition. And that just makes it really hard, like I said, over generations to pass down your faith. And if we're constantly having to reinvent it, you know, every year, I'm not a church planter, but I do know that I've met a lot of church planters, and a lot of them want to go out and they want to be the next, they're entrepreneurs in a way, right? They want to have the next great product, and they want to attract people from other churches, you know? And so, at one point though, are we going back to the James Wood point? Are we becoming so winsome that we have sacrificed the essence, you know, for the form?
Yeah, and I think with church planting particularly, there's a temptation. You can either have the treadmill of the church that trains you, or you can have the endless hamster wheel of innovation. And the hamster wheel of innovation is like exhausting for church planters. And I think that's why so many get either burned out, chewed up, hurt others, is because they're always trying to figure out either the next sermon series, the next song, the next set of church values, you know, whatever it is.
It is. Exhausting.
It becomes this leadership culture where you've constantly got to innovate in order to keep momentum. Because for a lot of Christians, like we had some Christians at our church who said, the minute this church stops growing, we know that the Spirit of God has left it, therefore we'll leave. And like, you hear that as a young church planner and you're like, okay, cool. That's pressure applied. Input received, I will now produce in order to grow, you know? And so a church plant needs to grow in order to receive funding, in order to receive all sorts of things. And whether that's rooted in a narcissism or a godly thing, that's between the church planter and a coach and other people to decide. But for a lot of them, the growth mindset, the innovation, I know for me, like, it just becomes exhausting. That's why when I talk to our church, I'm like, we don't have to do that. Let's just preach the Bible.
Right.
Let's sing good songs that already exist. We still sing songs that are coming out to try to connect with people, because people are going to listen to K-Love. They're going to listen to Christian radio. And I want to give them some connection, I guess. But, you know, I think it's just becomes a horrible thing for church planters. It's a bind that they get in, a deal they make with themselves and other people. That's why I see so many by the time they're 40, 50, they're like quitting ministry.
Yeah.
They deconstruct whatever it is, because the whole thing has just been, it's been a business, you know, and there are business components to starting a new church, no doubt.
Yep.
But it gets reduced to this entrepreneurial activity. And I'm like, just go start a great business. Like, you don't have to like go start a plumbing business and put a cross on it. Cause in some ways that might be better for your soul than slapping a cross on this church and you being the pastor of it. That's going to crush you and your family.
Yeah, I had never thought of that, Chase. It must be absolutely exhausting to try to be new and fresh every Sunday. And it contrasts so much with the lectionary. You know, every year we're praying the same prayers, you know, on this Sunday, and we're reading the same, you know, scriptures and all of that. I think what we forget, though, is, and this goes back to anthropology, is that every year I'm different, and I need to hear the same scripture because I'm different now, and I need to hear it over and over again. I don't even need a fresh take. I just need to be reminded.
You know?
And it'll hit me differently. And, you know, another reason I like the Anglican Church is I've tried to, as much as I can, and I have to use prudence here still too, but I don't do the church shopping thing to the greatest extent as much as I can. I just go to the Anglican Church that's closest to me, and I don't go in asking, what are you going to do for me? You know, like, what do you have for me? I come in saying, you know, I'm here to worship the Lord among other believers. And obviously there are heresy and things that I can't stand. If they're there, I'm going to have to leave. But the benefit of the doubt is with the church generally, broadly understood. And that we bristle, I think Protestants and Americans bristle against that. Our independence, you know, we want to be able to be our own judge in all cases. And, you know, the hierarchy of the Anglican Church with priests and bishops and all of that, I find it's been very helpful for me to submit to that structure.
Yeah.
Again, doesn't mean that there's not a time to revolt, and the Anglican Church in North America has. We left the Episcopal Church just as the, you know, reformers left the Roman Catholic Church. There is a time for that. But going back to that idea of that need for guardrails to keep us from saying, oh, actually, I'm just going to not go to church anymore. I mean, especially this side of COVID. I mean, I'd be curious to hear from you. How many people have you talked to who just say, you know what? I mean, just last week, this was a woman I met at my church. Anglican, by the way, right? She said we got into the habit of going to the lake on the weekends during COVID.
Right.
And we just Zoom into church. And, and this was interesting, Chase. I said, fascinating. I said, but how do you get communion? And she said, I get it spiritually. And I said, No, you don't.
Sure.
It doesn't work that way, sweetheart. That's why it's called the body of Christ.
But this has been an interesting discussion.
Yeah, but she said it to me like, of course, you know what I mean, right? I get the spiritual communion. And I'm like, my old Protestant brain says, I know exactly what you mean. But my new brain says, sorry, it doesn't work that way.
Doesn't work that way. Even in our church, early on, we had to say, hey, because I heard, you know, of a small group at our church taking communion at home while they were watching live stream. And we had to send out a church-wide email and be like, we understand the impulse.
Yeah.
And we would discourage you from doing that. That's not how it works. When we resume in-person services, we will take communion together. And even now, as we build out the building, we're trying to go, okay, this whole live stream business, which we invested in early on because we had no idea how long our local government would be very punitive, because they were very punitive towards churches. And so we at least got the equipment we need to survive, including an FM transmitter so we could broadcast over the radio, which was crazy.
Over the mountains,
And so now we're going, okay, at some point we got to cut the feed, you know, or at some point, like, how do we pastor people that have gotten into this habit without totally cutting them off from Christ? Because it's not a healthy spiritual, it's not a healthy Christian practice to do this. So it's but the whole Zoom prayer, Zoom, even us on podcast, I listened to a Ars Politica the other week with Thomas Acord, and he talked about this, how even the technology required to capture my voice in this microphone, for me to hear your voice in my headphones, for us to talk over this, it's a very disembodied thing. And every time I do an interview, I get off the interview and I feel almost disappointed because I don't get the full sense of who you are,
right,
and where you are, and the heat in the room and the lighting and all that stuff through a screen. And so Protestants and modern people just have such a diminished value of the body. Which is why they're okay with people butchering their own bodies to try to record with their ideas. It's nuts.
Well,
I wanted to go ahead.
I just have one point to say because it's a point you made, which is what we're seeing this side of COVID, right? As exemplified by this woman's comment, she and her husband, they've gotten into the habit of going to the lake for the weekends and Zooming church. It proves my point. Right, that we, anthropology, human beings are what? We are beings that we get habits. And my response to her was, get out of that habit. Get an come back.
Get a new habit.
The habit of coming to church. Here's a community that meets. But here's the point. You don't get to either make habits or not. It's just, what habits are you making? And what I'm afraid is that we have facilitated the habituation of Zoom church. That you're right. It is now. We're going to have to offend some people and cut the cord, cut the feed, and say, you have to come back. And now, something that the Anglican Church has always done, which is, we have, at the end of Eucharist, the communion service, we bless some elements, and some people take it to the sick who are not able to be there. And we pray for those people, and we lament that they can't be there with us, and we grieve that, I believe, a Christian way, but that we don't pretend that they can just Zoom in and it's just as good. I hadn't thought of this article in connecting with anthropology. It really deserves thinking now that we have habituated people in really potentially harmful ways. How can we? What habits do we need to overcorrect, perhaps, in order to get them back here?
Right.
Maybe have more services in person during the week, or something like that. Have some kind of incentive. I don't know what, but the question is, again, it's not, you know, should we have habits or not? It's, what habits are we encouraging?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point to bring up. It's one I write about in my book. I'll have to send you a copy if you haven't read it yet, because I deal with Smith. My friends joke, because my goal is twofold. One, it's for Smith to blast me in a review. that was one goal, because I do critique him. And they all know they can so-called trigger me if they will send me James K. Smith material, because I think he has great stuff to offer, like we've talked about in this, but I critique him. I wanted to talk, if people get on your Twitter feed, they're going to notice this isn't a main area necessarily for you. What a main area seems to be for you, I don't know what your new position entails. It sounds important, global leadership and stuff, but political theology or politics in general. I talked with Ben Crenshaw about politics and the difference between politics and political science, but you're going to be speaking at NatCon. I think that's National Conservative Conference. What is that?
That's right. Yeah. National Conservatism has these conferences that we refer to as NatCon. I've never participated until recently, but it's been a movement that has been led predominantly by Jews and Roman Catholics. And last year they all looked around and said, okay, this movement's starting to gather some speed, but where are the Protestants? This is a Protestant country. There needs to be some Protestant leadership. And so some of them reached out to me and a couple other people, and we've been trying to they've asked us to join them and help explain what does a positive vision of political theology look like. And it's something that I want to say is something that people took for granted for so long. I was just reflecting earlier today. We had summer commencement here at Troy University, which is a state school, and I lost count of how many times God and Scripture were mentioned and brought up. This is a state school, and it used to be like that all over the country. You read, as I've done a lot, Abraham Lincoln's speeches, and they're just dripping with King James Bible, and he doesn't even have to cite it. And it's funny, I've read this speech with Roman Catholics and Protestants, and the Roman Catholics have no idea what he's talking about, but the Protestants will pick it up, probably because it's King James, but also because they just know the Bible better. The Bible and Scripture used to be part of our public way of living, and we've lost that.
Right.
And it's an important question to ask why we've lost that. But here we are, and now we're having to make the argument that there is a reason, and it's important to talk about our faith in the public square, while respecting wide tolerance for religious liberty and an individual's perspective as well, but also not forgetting that religious liberty means getting to be able to speak about your faith, and recognizing that the majority in this country is Christian, and you don't have to apologize for that.
Right.
You shouldn't, as I've heard it said, keep your, be a closeted Christian. You shouldn't have that. So at NatCon, I'm chairing a panel with a number of other people who are going to help articulate what a positive view of political theology means, and it's something that, like I said, I think people used to know in their bones, and we've sort of lost it now. And there's a certain strand of of Protestantism that, again, following James Wood and all that, right? It's everything's for the spread of the gospel. That we don't want to offend anyone, and so we must
we must
keep our Christianity out of the public realm so that it can remain what Andrew Walker calls a contestulocracy, a constant marketplace of ideas where no idea ever wins out, but that occasionally people are sort of persuaded to join some private, you know, party, but that the public realm is never dominated by any one perspective. And there's a view of American history and American politics that makes one think that that's what the founders intended. And it doesn't take very much reading of the actual things that the founders said to know that that's not exactly accurate. You know, they didn't have this idea of freedom from religion. That wasn't part of the founding. That wasn't the First Amendment. It's something I'm excited about. I think it's something that's really important. And it's connected to this topic because part of the fetishization of mere Christianity, right, is this idea that it's just very, very bare minimum thing. And in the right. public square, it's barely at all. There's almost nothing. In fact, some people would say that their faith requires that. I wrote, the only other thing I think I've published with Ad Fontes is a review or a response of Andrew Walker's book, Liberty for All, which really gets to that question. So if any of your listeners are interested in the question, what should faith and Christianity look like in the public square? I recommend they read that article, and if they're interested, they can read Andrew Walker's book. I disagree with the vast majority of it, but I did appreciate how he laid things out, and it helped clarify some things for me. So,
yeah, and personally, when I listened to, I think it was a discussion you had or you might have hosted with Andrew on that book, and the critique which made me look in the mirror was that, maybe Stephen Wolf said it, I don't remember who said it, was that I appreciate that Andrew Walker is being a consistent Baptist.
That's right.
Yeah. Right. And he's living out what we think about Baptists to be true anyways. And I was like, uh-oh.
That's not good. No, it's true. I wasn't going to say it. But the very end of that book, he has an appendix, which was an article that he published independently. And his view of religious liberty, he says, must lead one into the walls of a Baptist church. And if you're listening to this podcast and you're wanting to know what in the world, why was that true? It was very enlightening for me to read that explanation. And it's very consistent internally. It's persuasive. But you have to accept certain assumptions. And if you accept those assumptions, then yes, I think you do end up in the walls of a Baptist church. But what I want to think, one of Andrew Walker's students, William Wolf, is exploring this question, and I think in his master's thesis, is that you don't accepting certain Baptist beliefs does not necessarily mean you have to end up with these views of religious liberty. So that's still an open question and one that people are still kind of asking right now. So
absolutely, you'll get people like Joe Rigney, who I think I want to have on to talk about this. I've had him on before, calling themselves magisterial Baptist.
Yeah, right.
And I really do appreciate it because that's my vibe right now. That's how I'm navigating. I'm trying to sense, okay, as I research 16th century Protestant Puritan thought, how did they comport and when did they arise and that kind of thing. So that's a topic for another day, though.
Right.
Well, Clifford, thanks so much for joining me today. This was a great conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to point people to your Twitter bio. I'll put that in the show notes. Is there anything else? I'll drop the link to the Ad Fontes articles that you mentioned, any other books, resources that you would want to point people towards to keep up with what you're thinking about?
Yeah, well, like I said, the main thing is that Jonathan Swift book, which will be coming out now. There's nothing, Davenant Press is going to be publishing it. And
okay, great. You
know, we'll be saying a lot more about it, but we're going to make it as accessible as possible because right now it is a little hard to read. But if you're interested, you can find that. It's free online right now, the A Tale of a Tub, but the more complex version. But be looking for the simplified with commentary and a robust introduction version coming out maybe in the spring of 2023.
That's great. Well, I'm looking forward to that. If you're a listener and you enjoyed this episode, I'd love for you to share it with somebody who's thinking about these things. If you've been thinking about it with your family, have your spouse listen to it. Give us a great review, subscribe, hit the notification button. That's the way you get notified that a new podcast or video is dropped. And then I've got the Patreon link down in the bio. I've got a few people that have signed up, and that's been such a blessing to help bring this platform to you so we can have great guests like Dr. Clifford Humphrey on the channel. So thanks so much for joining us today, and we'll see you next time.